thanks for coming on with me, Danny. There's a couple issues we want to discuss today, but one, since you've been writing a lot about this, is the newest iteration of Paul Ryan's budget, which has gone through multiple variations now. I think the first one was introduced in 2009, and it's kind of evolved every year. And this year, it almost seemed like there was not a whole lot of fanfare involved with the release of his updated budget, whereas in the past it was kind of a large event that congressional Republicans and conservatives in D.C. all kind of focused on a lot more heavily. Now, there are probably a couple different reasons for this, but first I wanted to get your take on what's in the budget, how it compares to previous years, and kind of the feasibility involved in enacting some of the requests that he's got in there.
Yeah, I think to start, one of the main reasons that it hasn't gotten nearly as much attention or fanfare is because we don't need to put a budget out for next year. Senate Democrats aren't putting one out. The Murray Ryan budget deal that we passed a few that Congress passed a few months ago sets the top line numbers for fiscal year 2015. So the policy implications for this aren't particularly high. So you haven't seen many Republicans, stand up for different features or really promote it just because it doesn't actually matter that much in a policy sense. Politically, it definitely has its own meaning and it lays out kind of a vision for the Republican Party. And a lot of those pieces in it are pretty heavy cuts to programs for low-income Americans, which is what you've seen Democrats jump on in the past week. And I also think those attacks are things that Republicans don't necessarily want to be associated with during an election year, which is another reason that you've seen them maybe take a step back. And on the other side of that, these cuts also keep the sequesters, the relaxation to the sequester that was part of the Murray Ryan budget deal, which the really hard fiscal conservatives in the House don't like. And so they've grumbled about that as well. So you've seen different pushback on court of different sides of it. And then the lack of policy implications because of it, I think, is a reason that you've seen less fanfare all around.
That's true. I didn't actually factor that in, and that's an interesting point to be made that Republicans sort of forced Democrats' hands, and it was a talking point for years for Republicans on Capitol Hill that we're putting out this budget, we stand behind Paul Ryan's budget, and our colleagues on the other side of the aisle are completely unserious about this because you haven't seen them put out a budget. And then last year, they tied an increase in the debt ceiling to kind of a demand for a budget from the Democrats. And the Democrats actually put that out. And interestingly enough, they worked through it, like you said, and we ended up with the Ryan Murray budget, which is kind of a document that is something that will generally be followed by Cap. I mean, kind of tried to generally follow on Capitol Hill. So that's an interesting point to be made, is that the Ryan budget has turned from something from kind of a demand and challenge to Democrats to something that's a little bit outdated and probably, like you said, more of a political document than a policy document. I'm not sure that Republicans are uncomfortable standing behind the cuts to some low-income programs and obviously on the discretionary side of things, because they stood behind it in the past and won on it. And you saw it in 2010, which was the second year and contained a lot of the same parts of the budget, and Republicans won on it. And I think that if you talk to Republicans, they'll say that it hasn't that that hasn't really been an albatross electorally. I think that what you might see from Republicans is there is this kind of divide on Capitol Hill now, specifically over some of the sequester spending, in that the Ryan budget hews to some of the increased caps of the Ryan Murray budget, but also keeps discretionary spending low and increases defense spending. And we've seen some fairly high-profile Republicans on Capitol Hill want to actually hew to some of the defense spending caps that were there in the past. So, and that is kind of exacerbating this intra-party Republican tension on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. And to go back to your point about Republicans' fears for political reasons about the cuts to low-income Americans within the budget. You're much closer to the Republican Party than I am, so you have better knowledge of this. I think there's a worry about maybe thinking 2010 was which factor really saved them in 2010. There were a lot of different reasons that Republicans kind of swept so well into office that year. You had the economy still was not doing well. There's huge anger at Obamacare, and then you also had the Ryan budget, which conservatives were rallying around at that point.
Right.
So, which one of those factors was, most substantial in driving them to victory is hard to play out. There's been a lot of arguments over the years about it, and it's really hard to tell whether it was a positive, negative. And as these the budgets continue, as you continue to put out these budgets, and Democrats continue these attack lines over and over again, I think there can be a greater extent that things can sink in. But I agree that I don't see Republicans running away from it for the same reason I don't think Democrats should run away from Obamacare. They voted for it. They've supported it. Your name is already attached to this. No matter how much you disown it, you're attached to this already. You should stick up for what you've put your name behind before and what you have supported. And when you kind of go flip-flopping in between and get concerned about, the optics of what you've done in the past or how it looks in the future and start switching between policies, that's when you can get really into trouble where voters don't really know what you think. And you get caught with that flip-flopping critique.
Right, yeah. Not that no, I'm not saying that I'm not saying that the Ryan budget was, a pro electorally for Republicans. I'm just saying that they didn't consider it to be a negative. And largely, you and I can debate about well, and we'll probably agree on how economic fundamentals matter so much more. They dwarf everything else in consequence when it comes to elections. But politicians don't think that way. Politicians think like Politico thinks. They pay attention to the minutiae, and they care. By and large, they ignore the structure. I mean, both Republicans and Democrats probably ignore the structural issues involved in every election and kind of pay attention to these back and forth poll swings that don't that are more of more consequence to them and probably matter more to them. Because if you come to a politician and say nothing you do matters, only the performance of the economy matters, that will depress them, A, and B, they'll deny it because they want to think that what they're doing and what they say and their platform and all of that is what voters care about. Getting back to the Ryan budget, what I wanted to kind of talk through with you, and I wanted to get your opinion on, so they a big deal was made of what Paul Ryan tried to do in this budget was get it to balance in 10 years, which in and of itself is interesting because his original budget didn't try to balance in 10 years. And actually some of the hardcore fiscal conservatives hit him on that. And after Ryan's first budget came out, and after Senator Rand Paul was elected to Congress, he put out his own budget that did balance in 10 years and said, look, it's possible. Ryan is just not serious enough on fiscal issues to get a 10-year balancing budget. And that kind of forced him to try harder to get balance in 10 years. And in this budget, one of the ways he does that is what's called dynamic scoring, where he claims that the macroeconomic effects of some of the policies, specifically of reducing America's debt load relative to GDP, will increase economic growth. And the CBO came out and said, we don't do that, and we can't do that, and we won't do that. And this is an issue that conservatives have been in favor of for years, is implementing dynamic scoring because under static scoring, they don't get the benefits of what they claim are the economic benefits of their plans. Now, Paul Ryan claims, I think it's actually a very small amount of deficit reduction when you get down to it. It's like in 2024, he's $50 billion off, I think, and claims that the dynamic scoring effects would erase that $50 billion gap, and he would actually have a balanced budget in 2024. What's your take on, the Republicans kind of pushing to implement dynamic scoring and its effects here specifically on Paul Ryan's budget plan?
Dynamic scoring to me has always made inherent sense in the idea that if you can create some, put in some policy that's going to increase economic growth, you can bring in more revenues from that. And that seems to flow logically. How you figure out, you know, how much extra economic growth you get and therefore how much extra revenue you get has always been a difficult calculation in my mind. And I would like to see CBO try it. And I know they've put out done a little work on it in the past, but they refuse to really use it for any typical budget analysis. So I'd like to see them dive a little bit more into dynamic scoring and try to put it out more. The Ryan budget's use of it is a little more iffy in my mind, especially because he's basically cutting a huge amount from spending and expecting this kind of fiscal austerity or expansionary austerity in terms of the dynamic scoring aspect to it. And particularly in the next couple of years when, you know, we're not going to get back to our full economies, to full health for a few years from now, really at the best possible scenario. And we're still going to have this hole in aggregate demand that we need to fill. And if you're taking money out of the economy by cutting spending drastically, particularly once we get to 2016, 2017, when, you know, the economies will be better, whether it'll be back to full health is pretty hard to see. And so to expect that those cuts are then going to turn around and lead to more expansionary GDP growth and increased revenue seems a little bit tough to believe for me.
Right.
So dynamic scoring in general, I support the intrinsic idea of it. I want to see more budget organizations kind of use it, really test out different sides of it. I'm worried about relying on it too much in terms of a huge amount of fiscal revenues in the future, just because if it doesn't appear,
right,
that's a big hole. And in terms of the Ryan budget, I'm very suspicious of that aspect of the score. But as you said, it's also a small amount. So relative to the overall, it's not that important.
Right. That's actually interesting. I am generally, in terms of budget organizations, I'm generally against them using dynamic scoring because it just seems like the reason you generally don't do dynamic scoring is that the economic literature is so murky on the subject of like actually how much growth you would get from dynamic scoring. And actually, interestingly, I think since you brought up kind of short-term discretionary cuts taking money out of the economy, dynamic scoring would, you would think, in that case, work in the opposite direction, right? If you're taking money out of the economy, and austerity is, you know, on net shrinking the economy, you would expect less revenue in the near-term years, right? And again, to me, I would say the economic literature is so murky on that as well. You can't really project with any certainty some very hard numbers on exactly how much would get taken out, and then in the out years, how much would get put back in. I think that macroeconomic modeling firms do a lot of good work on this. I'm usually skeptical, though, of budgeting organizations trying to claim that there are going to be definite effects in both directions here.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want CBO to issue it as their main baseline. They do alternative analysis all the time.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I would like to see them use it and just, you know, put it out there as a possibility. They can be very cautious with how they lay it out there, you know, lots of uncertainty, even if they put it out with a given range, but something to give an idea of what the potential effects potentially are.
Yeah. I mean, when it came to the sequester cuts, they did put out kind of a range of expectations of how they would affect each policy in, I believe, the sequester, how they would affect the economy. But they generally don't use those economic projections when it comes to actually budgeting both outlay and revenue projections. But another thing that I wanted to kind of get into was on the revenue side of Paul Ryan's plan. He kind of leaves it pretty murky. He basically puts out revenue goals each year and doesn't really say how you're going to get there. And actually, in the past, past Ryan budgets, he cut taxes relative to the baseline a lot more. But now it's only, you know, 0.1 or 0.2% of GDP, taxes as a percentage of GDP in some of the out years. So the tax projections that he's looking at are roughly in line with what current law is. And that's something that doesn't go over well with conservatives because a lot of the conservative base wants a net tax cut as, you know, part of the Republican policy platform. What's interesting is, in the past, Ryan has also left the revenue side very murky and said, you know, I don't want to step on Chairman Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp's toes, because that, you know, tax policy is his domain. And I kind of want to keep all the conservatives on all the Republicans on Capitol Hill happy. And Dave Camp did put out a tax plan recently that is roughly I use revenue neutral. And so that would kind of go in line with what Ryan is projecting as far as revenues go. So I'm wondering if you see kind of a prospect for a grand unified theory of conservative budgeting, combining some of what Rep. Camp has done and what Ryan is doing on more of the spending side of things.
Yeah, so Camp's tax plan to me was extremely impressive. He took a lot of conservative ideas and, you know, spent years putting together this intricate piece of legislation that, at least in the first decade, worked out to be roughly budget neutral. It may have some issues in the second decade because he had to do some timing tweaks with things. But overall, it really fulfilled a lot of main conservative ideas. And what you've seen is Republicans run away extremely quickly from it. You know, the bank tax infuriated Wall Street. So Republicans have sent a letter to Camp telling him that they should remove that. You know, they don't like carried interest tax at the at ordinary income rates. So they run away from that. They don't like the fact that Camp basically had to put in a 35% tax rate because he couldn't get the 10%, 25% to work. Yeah. They don't like that. And so you've seen kind of Republicans kill this tax reform plan immediately. And then Dave Camp announced his retirement last week, and it's unclear if those are unrelated.
Right.
One of the things I noticed in the Ryan budget is that his tax reform section really only lays out a couple of conservative goals, and they're the general goals that have been laid out over the past few years. He wants to stick to the 10% and 25%. Dual rate structure, which I personally don't believe is possible to create a tax plan that works like that. I think Dave Camp tried to do that, and he just couldn't get the revenue to be there. Unless you want to make it in deficit increasing a lot. If you're trying to cut revenue, you have a huge tax cut, which, as you said, some conservatives want. Then you can do that because it'll just cost a lot of money. But at the same time, then this budget plan isn't going to be deficit neutral over 10 years, because the revenues are supposed to be deficit neutral in here. If Ryan makes it be a tax cut, then this is not balancing the budget. So I think there's an inherent contradiction between what Paul Ryan is offering in the tax plan and what is really achievable. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested to see how that plays out in the next year, because he is rumored to be taking over for Camp as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee starting next year, which means he will be involved in tax reform, and he will actually have to, you know, get going on this piece of legislation, especially because it's the holy grail of every chairman of Ways and Means.
Yeah.
So how he balances the goals he laid out in this budget with the, you know, realistic possibilities of tax reform next year is going to be difficult. And it's something that I wrote about last week, that he's really constrained his options for what he can do on tax reform as chairman. And I'm not sure it was the smartest decision by him.
Yeah, that's true. Ryan's been kind of rumored to want to have his eyes on Ways and Means chair for a long time. And obviously Camp's retirement leaves that door open. It seems like, and maybe you might think I'm giving Ryan too much credit here, but he does actually want to have plans that work, right?
I agree.
And I'd be interested to see, because like you said, Camp's plan is really impressive, and he took a lot of risks. He actually made a plan that it relies on a couple of gimmicks that are, you know, not great, but it's pretty good. You know, it's like 80% of the way there.
And everything in Washington relies on gimmicks at some point, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, there was a, you know, part of the Ryan plan, he uses war spending drawdown as to reduce.
So does President Obama's budget as well.
Everyone's budget uses war spending drawdown, and that's one of the easiest and cheapest gimmicks of budgeters in Washington. But I'd be interested to see how Ryan's tax plan as Ways and Means Chairman would differ from Camp's, because Camp seems to include most kind of mainline conservative ideas about tax reform. And then the ways that he differs from that are just ways to make it work at all. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think he calls the 35% bracket like a special surtax bracket.
Yes. Yeah.
Trying to get around that and say, I have two brackets, except for this strange situation that I'm calling a super bracket, or I don't even remember what the language was, but it was, you know, 10%, 25%. Oh, and PS, there's also a 35% bracket. So I'd be interested to see how Ryan would differ from that, because it seems like Camp has included most of the Republican priorities in his tax reform plan, while also making it deficit neutral and kind of as friendly to business as possible, but still like recognizing the realities of how you can make the numbers work.
Yeah, and that's where I see the contradiction in Ryan's plan. If the budget is supposed to be revenue neutral, it's supposed to balance the budget in 10 years, and revenues are supposed to stay at what he's listed here, then his tax reform has to be deficit neutral. And he set out goals for tax reform here that Camp started with as well, and Camp really couldn't fulfill all those goals, specifically the two rates at 10 and 25%, because he just couldn't get the revenues to work. So if Ryan is going to try to stick to those goals, he's not going to be able to get the revenues to work either, which means it's going to be deficit increasing, which means this plan will not balance the budget.
Yeah.
So one of these two sides have to give. Either Ryan's going to have to relinquish on some of these tax reform goals, which is what I would expect once he becomes Ways and Means Chairman. And I mean, maybe he put out these goals because he felt like he's still competing for the chairmanship. And if he relaxed them a little bit, then he could risk losing it. I'm not really sure. Maybe there are some internal Republican politics involved there that mattered to him, in which case maybe this made sense for him to get the chairmanship first and then deal with the fallout afterwards. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure what's going on there. But I think that's something he's going to have to work out, and it'll be very interesting to see as he does as chairman, if he becomes chairman. Because I agree that he wants to get things done. He wants to put out serious policy proposals, and if he wants to put out a serious policy tax reform, he's going to have to deal with these trade-offs in terms of revenue.
Yeah. His chairmanship isn't guaranteed. I mean, he's by far the front runner, but Rep. Kevin Brady is, I think, technically next in line for Ways and Means chairmanship. And he said, you know, I'm not going to let that go without a fight. Mm-hmm. And he's more of a darling of kind of base conservatives. You know, by the really hardcore Republican base, some people, you know, say that Paul Ryan's a sellout, specifically for not including net tax cuts in his budget plans. And Kevin Brady's hews a little closer to those people who are critics of Ryan, are critics from the right of Paul Ryan. And I think that the next years will be very interesting for Ryan's career, because I thought it was odd in the first place that he accepted the vice president slot on Mitt Romney's ticket. It kind of coincided with his rising star. But maybe I'm giving him too much credit here. I think that he should have been able to read the tea leaves that Romney was going to get beaten. And it was, you know, the election was trending away from Romney for a long time. And now he, you know, goes back to the House and tries to reassume the mantle of wonky budget guy. And I'd be really interested to see if he continues to hold aspirations for higher office, because he does seem interested in kind of staying in the House. He's, you know, kind of a dark horse presidential contender, but in the modern era, we don't often see people go from the House to the presidency. You need a senatorship or a governorship, or if he had been, you know, a vice president. But I'm not sure that he holds aspirations for higher office like that. So I'd be interested to see like what he does with Ways and Means chairmanship, and kind of if he uses that as you know, coming up with a grand unified Republican budget, or if he's going to use it as a springboard to higher office.
I think there can be some overlap there too. If he tries to, you know, create this grand unified Republican budget, that can springboard him into higher office in a way. Yeah, and I also think that one of the reasons, I mean, I'm guessing here a little bit, but one of the reasons he accepted the VP nomination on Mitt Romney's ticket was because he wanted to get his name out there more. As you said, it's incredibly hard to jump from the House to the presidency, jumping from the vice presidency after a Mitt Romney presidency, if that were to happen, if that was part of his
right.
Calculation, would have obviously put him in a much better position. And I think right now he's probably in a better position than he was pre-Romney as well. The, you know, fallout from Romney's defeat, I don't think it's hurt him particularly much. He stayed out of the media shadow for a while, but he's really regained that serious budget wonk persona, especially going across the aisle and working with Patty Murray on the budget yeah. deal that we signed in January. Really, I think, gave him some bona fide moderate credentials. At the same time, it angered a lot of conservatives, so there's always a balance there that he has to strike. Mm-hmm. And going back to this Ryan budget helps him then kind of tilt back towards conservatives. So I would say he's kind of in this balancing act and he wants to leave doors open. I don't see him running in 2016 right now, but that leaves his options pretty open beyond that. And it's hard to think of a way from someone in the House to gain more notoriety and fame than being part of a presidential ticket.
Yeah.
So if he wants to really, especially because the risks for him there weren't too bad, they got in terms of losing faith from conservatives or taking a beating on the national stage. So I think this has all been kind of a process where he may not know what he wants to do, but he knows he has a lot of options. He could play out in the House and go back and run for governor in Wisconsin if Scott Walker
yeah.
became president or something like that. So, you know, continue to put in the Ryan budget, continuing to keep a balance as a serious wonk while keeping support of the conservative base is probably the line he wants to walk right now, just to leave as many doors open for himself as possible.
Yeah. Interestingly, I think his budgets each year have gotten more political and kind of coalition based. And I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like there are massive changes being made every year, but just kind of incrementally, it seems like it's been more building generalized Republican support outside of, I would say, his plans on Medicare. On Medicaid, he wants to block Grant, which is kind of the default conservative line. On Medicare, he's currently got a variation on the plan he developed with Alice Rivlin. And originally, Rivlin kind of skewered him for that plan because it took away traditional Medicare as an option in this competitive bidding structure that he's come up with, mm-hmm. Well, that they came up with. And after that, he actually reinstated, you know, having traditional Medicare as a competitor to the competitive bidding process. And this year, he actually, in his budget, increased kind of the generosity of, well, the potential generosity of the private Medicare competitors. By going from, you know, average, you know, this is deep in the weeds here, but average second lowest bid to average bid overall as the traditional Medicare competitor. And that part of the plan doesn't get, that seems, I mean, maybe it's too in the weeds for most conservative legislators, but that part doesn't seem to attract a whole lot of controversy on Capitol Hill, that he went from a really, really privatized Medicare plan to one that is a lot more, probably a lot more politically possible for, you know, seniors who are seen as, you know, the, you know, third rail here, that you can't touch their benefits. But on Capitol Hill, Republicans haven't really hit him on abandoning this really hardcore privatization line in favor of maybe something that's more politically possible. So I'm not sure where his Medicare plan goes from here, but to me that seems like the most potentially viable piece of his budget, and that's something that you could probably separate out from the rest of the budget and just come up with a Medicare reform plan alone.
Yeah, and you know, he had worked with Ron Wyden to do something like that before as well, and Democrats aren't going to be a huge fan of that. I think it goes back to just why this hasn't gotten much increase. It is why it hasn't gotten much notoriety. It is in the weeds, wonky talk, and you know, it's not going to be great for a talking point anywhere. And it's also, because of that, tough to criticize Ryan over, just because very few people are digging in this deep and understanding it in that way. Mm-hmm. And in addition, he doesn't get meant, at least in the 10-year window, much budget savings from Medicare. It's like $100 billion or something like that. Right. He's, you know, saving $5 trillion over it. So the cuts are pretty small overall, which is why I think that it takes less attention away from it. Democrats are really focused on the hits to discretionary spending, the Affordable Care Act, and Medicaid. So all their attacks are there, and they try to drive that news cycle. And that kind of plays out in that manner where Republicans are kind of fending off those attacks a little bit and promoting their plans on those sides of it. And Medicare may get lost a little bit, particularly because it's a wonkier topic here and the changes are tougher to understand, especially because he's still calling it kind of a premium support
Right.
quasi plan. So the top line budgeting wording of it hasn't changed that much, and you have to dig deeper to really get to it.
Maybe you know this though. I feel like it was a bigger deal a couple of years ago, but Medicare spending itself has slowed down so much. Is that the reason that he's not getting much savings there? That our, projected trend line for Medicare spending is so much lower now than it was a couple of years ago?
That'd be interesting. I'm not actually sure if that's true, but that would be a very interesting to look up just because he does get very little spending from Medicare, though he also saves the $700 billion from the Affordable Care Act, the cuts to Medicare and that. So he says he'll repeal all of the Affordable Care Act in there, but he retains $700 billion in Medicare cuts, but because those are
Right,
already
yeah.
part of current law, they don't show up. So inherently, if you think about him repealing all of Obamacare and then adding those cuts back in, there's $800 billion in cuts, which is significant. But because of how the baseline works, those don't show up. But I think there probably is something too, we having bent the cost curve a little bit, that we don't have as the cuts don't show up as significantly as in past years.
And certainly not in the 10-year budget window.
Yeah.
Moving on, I think I did want to ask you a little bit about, so Paul Ryan has, I don't remember, 733, close to $800 billion in savings from repealing coverage expansion of Obamacare. To me, and I've said this on Blogging Heads before when I've argued with conservatives, Obamacare looks to be settling into a status quo that is probably conservatives' nightmare, right? You're getting to a point where there are people who have coverage, and the old conservatives' criticisms of Obamacare will rise up again, which is that, conservatives don't think that the plans will be great, they'll be slightly too expensive. But it's at a point where those are kind of hidden in the status quo, and the loss aversion of taking away subsidies, which is primarily where Ryan's getting his savings, is going to be a very powerful political kludge to use against anti-Obamacare people. And I wanted to kind of get your take on where, how the status quo kind of settles in here, and if, it's going to, that the ACA is going to be a problem for, not exactly for on the electoral side, but like something that Republicans will just keep talking about now that our first open enrollment period is over, we've got a midterm election, and then after that, it the prospects for it collapsing under its own weight, which was the Republican fever dream over the last few years, look to be just about gone.
Yeah, and I think part of that is repeal, in my mind, is just about gone as well. You're going to have a pretty large coalition of people who received insurance through Obamacare. You're going to have a lot of hospitals and doctors who've changed their systems to accommodate these new patients. And repealing this and going back to the status quo before and just isn't possible. And I think Ryan includes the repeal in his budget just because it's pretty good conservative red meat, and the base is not ready to give up on this idea of repeal yet.
Yeah, they would hit him hard. If it wasn't in there, they would hit him hard on,
Exactly.
not being for repeal of Obamacare.
And that's going to be something a lot of Republicans struggle with the next couple of years, is how to keep the repeal line to keep the conservative base happy while being realistic that if I support repeal, I'm telling millions of people that I'm going to eliminate their insurance. So that's a very tough position to navigate as well. I actually, last week, Ryan made some comments about repeal, I think to Washington Post, I forget where, about how it wasn't mathematically possible to keep some of the guarantees for people with pre-existing conditions and to keep some of the allowing young adults under the age of 26 to stay on their parents' health plan, and how keeping premiums low while allowing those features to still exist was really difficult to complete and to make happen, which I thought it was great to hear him at least say that and admit that that's a big issue that Republicans have to deal with. You want to keep some of the popular features to the law, but get rid of some of the unpopular ones, it becomes a very unstable law. And if the Republicans are the reasons behind those policy strategies, they're going to take a political hit from that. And Ryan was at least admitting that trade-off that was inherent in repeal,
yeah.
which is something I think a lot of Republicans have shied away from
yeah.
recently. So it was good to hear him say that. But it's still going to be a tough balancing act in the years to come as he supports repeal and also has to deal with millions of people who've gotten insurance through Obamacare that are really set against repeal.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who kind of has a firm grasp on health policy knows that's the case, you know, that almost you could say that Obamacare's goal was simply to prohibit discrimination based on pre-existing conditions, and literally everything else is just to be able to make that work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep that and eliminate everything else, you know, you get New York, which was kind of in the middle of a death spiral. You know, they instituted, I don't remember if it was bans on pre-existing conditions or community rating, but they did it without a mandate, which means that, you know, people were waiting to get insurance until they were sick, and prices were skyrocketing, and it was a fairly bad status quo environment for the health insurance market in the state of New York. And yes, it is certainly refreshing to hear a Republican say, you know, we can't keep the good things from Obamacare and just get rid of the bad things, because really bad things happen if that were to be the case. But, you know, anyone who kind of does basically understand what's going on here knows that is the case.
Yeah.
And I think that the interesting thing will be if people like Paul Ryan do kind of start to accept Obamacare as status quo. I think it was Ramesh Panuru in Bloomberg View wrote, you know, it's time for conservatives to kind of start accepting that Obamacare is where we are now, and the way forward is changing it, not repealing it, and making changes here and there and everywhere that actually give us better health policy rather than changing it to try and hope that, you know, it collapses under a dysfunctional market or something like that, and they're forced to repeal, you know, all or most of it. I think you will see in the next few years the Republican pundit status quo shift towards this line, but it's going to be something that's going to be really hard to keep up, because it has been such a huge talking point with base Republican voters over the last few years that, because of the lag time involved in from when the legislation passed to when it went into effect, it was able to be used as a talking point. And now, because that might be gone, it's going to be really hard to give that up. You know, it has been a talking point for more than 4 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, will it take another 4 years to get over the dream of repeal? I don't know, but that might be the case.
Is Ted Cruz ever going to give up on the idea of repeal? I think, you know, there's a pretty good chance he's going to be running for president in 2016. And there's a pretty good chance he's going to be standing on the stage saying, the first thing I will do in office is issue waivers to every state to repeal Obamacare.
Right.
And how do you respond to that if you're someone who wants to win the general election? Because that's at that point, it's going to be a very tough line in the general election, but it's going to work really well in the primary. And you're going to see a lot of Republican presidential candidates struggle to kind of decide there, because unless Ted Cruz shockingly moderates on repeal, which at least I don't see in the coming future, especially because he knows it works really well in the Republican primary, he's locked down that position. And
if he wants, he is senator for life from Texas, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to be a very tough balancing act. And as for the pre-existing conditions part, if you think of Obamacare, that one of the biggest goals was to make sure no one can be discriminated if they have a pre-existing conditions, it's tough to think that they haven't succeeded on that. Even the Republican
right.
plans that have come out now, the Senate one that came out earlier, even Jindal's plan, you know, a focal point of all of them are making sure that people with pre-existing conditions have the ability to purchase affordable health insurance. That's kind of become the new standard for any plan that you have to put out now, which is a pretty huge success for Obamacare, that they've changed the messaging and the baseline, allowing people to be discriminated against pre-existing conditions
right,
is not acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah, that is absolutely huge. I mean, in pre-Obamacare kind of conservative movement plans, taking a not it wasn't they kind of dealt with pre-existing conditions as a side issue with, you know, risk pools and things like that, usually state-based, that would say, you know, we're dealing with pre-existing conditions on either a one-time or sometime rolling basis. But the point is that, you know, everyone will get covered. And then once you're covered, you can't be pre-existing or you can't be discriminated against. And that, you know, we're going to kind of do it as a one-time thing. But now the debate is kind of accepting that there will always be a problem of pre-existing conditions in the insurance market. And this is something that basically any kind of comprehensive plan would have to deal with. And that is something that didn't exist in conservative circles pre-Obamacare and does now. So they have, I would say that, yeah, liberals have won the debate on that. You know, that's not, and probably liberals have won the debate on the general kind of goal of insurance market reform in general, that it used to be this kind of dichotomy of cost versus access, which one you prioritize over. Now it's, now everyone has to deal with access first over cost. And, you know, once we get to, I mean, I don't remember what the exact number is, but let's say Obamacare kind of goes through a status quo and we reach the numbers that were projected at passage, which is something like 95% of the American population is covered. It's not going to be this thing where basically any serious plan after that will say you have to continue to maintain a 95% coverage goal, or like no one's going to take your plan seriously. And you can tweak with costs around that, but it's going to be kind of marginally increasing access versus marginally decreasing costs. And that is kind of the status quo we're at now.
That's what makes repeal so difficult, because it doesn't fulfill those goals. And, you know, for the last few years, it did repeal before this became, before Obamacare went live. Repeal going back to the status quo was an acceptable serious policy proposal. Now it's not anymore. Yeah. And that's going to be a very tough thing for Republicans to kind of navigate in the upcoming years.
Yeah. And I mean, Republicans use the line that the kind of line that you, if you like your plan, you can keep it. And that was a broken promise and blah, 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 blah. But I don't think that the talking point was basically that President Obama used that line to sell Obamacare, and he lied about it. And basically, any major health reform will cause disruption in the market and cause people to lose their plans. And I don't think the subtlety of he lied to sell the thing versus you should never disrupt the market. I don't think that people probably got that. And because Republicans were kind of using that, it'll be hard for them to sell their own plan that will have fairly massive disruption. And any plan is going to have fairly massive disruption now. Well, if you're going to reform the Obamacare status quo, any plan is going to have massive disruption. And it'll be hard for Republicans to kind of deny the charges of hypocrisy that will come with any real change in status quo that they would propose.
Yeah, that's what I remember. Phil Klein wrote an article maybe last November-ish saying Republicans need to be careful with these attacks on Obama for lying, because if they come off as saying you can't disrupt the healthcare market, well, health reform is basically impossible.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially because one of the main conservative ideas is to reform or change employer-sponsored insurance, which is something I support as well, but which would be very disruptive to the market.
Yeah.
To the health market. And it's a tough balancing act where we probably should disrupt the healthcare market a pretty good amount because it's dysfunctional in many ways. But that's inherently going to require it to be disruptive. Yeah. And if Americans are dead set against disruptions right now, that rules out a lot of different policy ideas for both Republicans and Democrats. But because the charge came from Republicans, that hypocrisy does come off more.
I actually think that you look at polling on the issue, and it's kind of similar to that. I don't remember what the phenomenon is called, but people hate Congress, but generally like their own congressman. Pre-Obamacare, at least, people would all say, you know, the health insurance market is broken. But the people who had insurance would say, but I basically do like my health insurance. And any kind of any plan at this point, and once we get to a stable Obamacare, is going to have to face up against, people are going to generally like their insurance, even if, you know, health wonks will say it's bad in this way, it's good in this way, but there's a lot of improvement to be made. People will still say, yeah, but I like it. I don't want you to get rid of it. It's the loss aversion again. That,
and people don't like change.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, I think that's probably all the time we have for today. Thanks a lot for coming on with me, Danny.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I will see everyone else on the next episode of Rational Actors.